Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report, who assesses the escalation of Syria's civil war and the threat of a wider regional conflict. Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who puts Army Specialist Bradley Manning's current trial for the release of classified government documents in historical perspective. And Shahid Buttar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who explains why he believes the Obama Justice Department's surveillance of Associated Press reporters' phone lines directly threatens press freedom. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Nations is expanding its anti-poverty goals to eliminate extreme poverty by 2030 and expanding its development policies to include climate change, sustainable development, and gender equality. The new global goals set by a UN panel comprised of the heads of state of Indonesia, Liberia, and Britain will replace the Millennium Development Goals, which expire in 2015. The original goals were set to cut poverty in half, combat AIDS, and promote the health of women and children. The new goals, which will be revised over the next 2 years, are more ambitious. Among global advocates for the poor, a major disappointment was that the high-level panel did not develop a goal around economic inequality. Academics and advocates assert that extreme poverty will linger longer without a focus on inequality. Instead, the UN panel is narrowly relying on general economic growth as the most important tool to battle poverty. Economist Andy Summers of King's College London told The Guardian newspaper, "We find in our number crunching that poverty can only be ended if inequality falls. So one should ask, where is the inequality goal?" The Christian Science Monitor reports that new satellite intelligence shows North Korea is building a massive system of prison camps. These images and witnesses inside the North Asian country indicate the prison camps could hold upwards of 200,000 people. The evidence is so compelling, the United Nations in late March created a commission of inquiry to review charges leveled at North Korea for crimes against humanity. Genocide researcher David Hawk, who wrote a 2012 report on North Korea, observed, "Virtually every legal scholar and former tribunal judge looking at North Korea has come to the conclusion that there are massive crimes against humanity. A major inquiry into the severity of the police state in North Korea could have major political consequences in East Asia and put pressure on China, which repeatedly returns refugees back to North Korea." Officially, North Korea denies the existence of prison camps and insists there are no human rights violations in their people-centered socialism. Independent analysts believe there are currently 16 operating prison camps in the north, holding from 3,000 to 50,000 prisoners. With the outbreak of extreme weather and rising summer temperatures, there is greater demand for up-to-date flood maps. These maps, drawn by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, are used to set monthly premiums for flood insurance and help homeowners understand the risk of future floods. According to ProPublica, Congress has ignored the growing need for revised flood maps by slashing the funds allocated to this project in half since 2010. President Obama's current budget proposal further cuts the mapping budget by an additional $16 million. FEMA says further cuts will delay updating flood maps by 3 to 5 years. In New England, maps of interior rivers in many cases are 30 years out of date. In August 2011, heavy rains from Tropical Storm Irene ravaged Vermont, whose flood maps were highly inaccurate. FEMA flood maps are partially funded by the Federal Flood Insurance Program, but thus far, Congress has only approved spending one quarter of the $400 million earmarked for the Map Modernization Program. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
As the Obama administration and the government of Russian leader Vladimir Putin attempt to organize a peace conference to negotiate a diplomatic solution to Syria's bloody civil war, there are ominous signs that the conflict is escalating and destabilizing neighboring nations. At about the same time that Republican Senator John McCain met with rebel commanders inside Syria, advocating U.S. lethal assistance to the rebels, the European Union voted to lift a ban on the transfer of arms to forces of the Free Syrian Army. Meanwhile, Russia announced that it intended to fulfill a Syrian government order for sophisticated ground-to-air S-300 missiles. Israel, which has launched several recent airstrikes against various weapons caches inside Syria, warned that it may attack the S-300 missiles if delivered. On another front, the Lebanese Shiite militia group Hezbollah has sent thousands of its soldiers to prop up government troops loyal to Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad in several key battles against rebel strongholds. Another dangerous development in the war are the still unconfirmed and conflicting reports that one or both sides in the Syrian war have used chemical weapons. All told, an estimated 80,000 people have been killed in Syria and 4 million displaced since the war began in March 2011. It's become more apparent in recent months that the Syrian civil war has developed into a dangerous flashpoint for the regional conflict between Sunni and Shiite Muslims, pitting Shiite allies Syria, Iran, and Hezbollah against Sunni governments in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. Your reporter spoke with Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report, who assesses the escalation of Syria's civil war and the threat of a wider regional conflict.
There already has been spillover of the conflict into Turkey and to Lebanon, to some degree into Iraq as well. And any of these things could happen. I suppose in some ways, the scariest possibility is that this would somehow turn into a generalized Arab-Israeli war or a generalized war of some Arab countries and factions against Israel if Israel were to become involved. And Israel has hinted that it might resume airstrikes if Russia ships these missiles that can take down aircraft. So that is, you know, sort of the biggest possibility for a regional conflagration, but certainly with Hezbollah's deepening involvement, the possibility of fighting breaking out in Lebanon more severely than it has already is probably the most real possibility at this stage. And there has been already quite a bit of fighting in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli between forces that are considered to be loyal to the Syrian regime and forces that are considered to be more allied with the Syrian rebels. And that could intensify and spread throughout the country. And certainly the involvement of Hezbollah and the fact that Hezbollah is more and more emboldened about that and openly boasting of it is quite worrisome.
With John McCain in Syria meeting with Syrian opposition groups and opposition fighters, I wonder if you would just comment on where you think U.S. policy should go at this point, given the prospects for a peace conference sponsored by the U.S. and Russia are uncertain at this point.
Well, I think that one of the most insidious things that interventionists have managed to do with the English language in the last 20 years or so is that they have managed to define the term intervention such that when we hear that term, we automatically think military. There are other kinds of intervention that do not involve joining the fighting, and two of those things would be stepped-up diplomacy and also stepped-up humanitarian aid to try and deal with the horrible problem of the Syrian refugees who number in the millions and whose needs are not being met by and large and who may be displaced for years to come, given the fact that the fighting shows no sign of ending anytime soon. That is where U.S. efforts should be focused, on forms of intervention in this conflict that hold out the possibility of bringing it to a close and taking care of the people who have been victims of the conflict, rather than forms of armed intervention that simply promise to add more fuel to the fire.
This the civil war in Syria began as something related to the Arab Spring. You know, according to many observers, calls for democracy and overthrow of the Bashar al-Assad regime. But the allies of this movement in the rebel forces they represent include Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other Gulf states, which are decidedly undemocratic nations themselves. If you were to look into the future in a post-Assad government in Syria, what do you think we'll see?
Well, I would not even venture a guess on that last question. I would just underscore what you said, that at the beginning, the Syrian uprising was a genuine popular uprising. Syria was always a more divided polity than Egypt and Tunisia, for example. So, you know, it was not directly comparable, but it was a peaceful popular uprising that was making very similar demands to the ones made in Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, and elsewhere across the Arab world. It was the regime and its extreme violence that was the primary bad actor, turning that uprising into something closer to the catastrophe we see today. But it was also the meddling of these external powers. And Saudi Arabia, I think, deserves, well, shame of place, shall we say, in not only lending the fighting a sectarian cast, but also turning the overall dynamic and the overall feel of the situation from one of a popular uprising, which had a pro-democratic agenda, to one of civil war and a much more sort of existential struggle. And of course, Saudi Arabia is not only an undemocratic actor in the region, it is a very staunchly anti-democratic actor. And so I think another way of seeing Saudi and other Petro-Princeton intervention in the war in Syria is not in sectarian terms, but in anti-democratic terms, that this was one of the tactics by which Saudi Arabia sought to halt the spread of this very inspiring pro-democracy spirit that was in the air in the region in 2011.
That was Chris Tensing, Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of its publication, Middle East Report. For more news and analysis on the Syrian conflict, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The trial of Army Specialist Bradley Manning got underway this week in a military courtroom at Fort Meade, Maryland. Manning was arrested just over 3 years ago and charged with leaking hundreds of thousands of classified government documents to WikiLeaks. He has been held in prison since his arrest, including time held naked in solitary confinement, purportedly as a measure to prevent his suicide, although Manning was never determined to be a threat to himself. Among the documents Private Manning admitted to downloading and distributing was the so-called collateral murder video, showing a U.S. helicopter crew shooting and killing two unarmed local Reuters journalists and several civilians in Baghdad on July 12, 2007. In February, Manning pled guilty to some of the less serious charges, which could result in up to a 20-year prison sentence. During those court proceedings, he read a 10,000-word statement explaining how he hoped his actions would spark a dialogue about U.S. foreign policy. In the current trial, Manning now faces charges of espionage and aiding the enemy, and if convicted, could face life in prison. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Michael Ratner just before Manning's trial began. Ratner is president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights and the attorney representing Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, who received the government documents from Manning. Here, Ratner puts Manning's trial in historical perspective during the current post-9/11 era, when the Obama administration has prosecuted more whistleblowers than all other U.S. presidents combined. He also compares Manning's actions with that of another famous whistleblower, Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the top-secret Pentagon papers in 1971.
I was in court a few months ago when he pled guilty to a number of lesser-included charges that could give him a maximum of 20 years in jail. The judge hadn't sentenced him yet and won't until the end of the trial, so he could obviously get lower than the 20 years. But he did plead guilty to charges that could get him 20 years in jail. It was one of the more moving days I've spent in the courtroom. He gave his political reasons for everything from collateral murder video to the Iraq war logs. What's going on now is particularly nasty, because I think the hopes may have been that if he pleaded guilty to 20 years, the government would say, okay, we're not going to go ahead with this huge trial with 150 witnesses. It's going to take 3 or 4 months. That includes some very heavy charges like aiding the enemy and espionage, and can also get him life in prison, in fact, hundreds of years in prison. You would have hoped the government would come to their senses and say, this young man of conscience, no question he's a man of conscience who did what he thought was right, pled guilty, and let the judge decide what sentence he should get up to 20 years. Instead, they're going for everything about him. They obviously want to put him in jail for the rest of his life. That's really sad and outrageous. And they also want to get some precedents, I think, on the books about soldiers who whistleblow, give to media, whether it's the New York Times or WikiLeaks, and then are considered to be aiding the enemy by doing so.
What are the less serious charges that he did plead guilty to?
The basic charges were around unauthorized access to computers or misuse of computers, lower charges that carried sometimes 2 years, sometimes roughly in that area, and when they all added up, it came to 20 years. The bigger charges now have to do with two charges, espionage, which has a very long sentence attached to it, and of course aiding the enemy, which has a death penalty attached to it, actually, although the U.S. has said they won't ask for the death penalty. We'll see what happens. So he's facing a very, very heavy time. There's going to be a lot of witnesses at the trial that are secret witnesses. It's one of the more bizarre things of the trial that all of the documents that you and I and every person listening to the show can look at online, that WikiLeaks put up online, all of those documents are considered secret still by the government. And so every time one of those documents comes up in court, the court closes the courtroom, kicks everybody out, and discusses them, even though we all know what's in them.
Michael Ratner, in Bradley Manning's case, is the government alleging that anybody was actually harmed or injured or killed as a result of anything he released?
And that's very important. Both with Julian Assange and Bradley Manning, and of course Julian Assange and WikiLeaks published the documents, the initial spin by the administration is that they have blood on their hands. You know, people are going to be killed because of this. People who helped the United States in war-torn countries like Afghanistan, et cetera, are going to be injured. In fact, no evidence at all about anybody being injured, anybody having to move location, or anybody being killed as a result of these releases. What these releases are one, they're very embarrassing to the United States, but more so they do reveal criminality by the United States, the killing of thousands of civilians more than they acknowledged in Iraq, Afghanistan, the collateral murder video, secret wars in Yemen. The accountability that we ought to have here is not the accountability for what Bradley Manning did. It's accountability of our own government for what it did. And what we ought to be focusing on is not Bradley Manning in terms of persecution, but we ought to be going after the high officials of our own government who were involved in criminality.
I was in college when Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers, and my recollection is that he wasn't vilified the way Bradley Manning has been, and I'm not sure he spent any time in jail. It just doesn't seem there's been widespread outrage at Bradley Manning's brutal treatment since his arrest and imprisonment 3 years ago. Nor has there been widespread outrage about all the secrecy and the persecution of both whistleblowers and journalists. Are we just living in different times? And we should mention that Daniel Ellsberg has been one of Manning's most outspoken supporters.
What you're saying is very accurate. I mean, the difference is, I think one difference is, of course, when Daniel Ellsberg, who released the Pentagon Papers, which were actually top secret, nothing that Bradley Manning released was higher level secret. So what Ellsberg did, you could argue, at least from the government's classification point of view, was much more capable of causing damage than what Bradley Manning did. But there was a huge anti-war movement at the time Daniel Ellsberg did it. And so he was releasing those papers in a country that was, you know, tired of war, had gotten lied to about Vietnam. This is 1970 or 71. So in that context, he was looked at as a hero. He certainly was. I mean, he could have gone to jail. He was prosecuted for espionage. The trial ended badly for the government in the middle. But I think the political context was very different. And yes, I think we're moving a bit in that direction, but we're not there yet. You know, I'll conclude by really two things. One is that the government ought to just back off at this point. I would hope this trial collapses in a very short order. The government accepts the guilty plea of the 20 years that he pleaded to, and we go to a sentencing phase. That's the minimum I would hope for. The maximum, of course, I would hope that he gets released, gets time served, and gets a medal on his chest, because that's what he deserves.
That was Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights and attorney representing Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks. Find more perspectives on Private Manning's trial by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Last month, the Associated Press revealed that the Obama administration's Department of Justice had secretly collected 2 months' worth of the news agency's reporters' phone call records from several bureau offices, the House of Representatives press gallery, and individual journalists' home and cell phones. The Justice Department's collection of these phone records is linked to the agency's investigation into a government leak which surfaced in a 2012 AP story about a foiled terrorist bomb plot in Yemen targeting a U.S.-bound airliner. In a related development, the Department of Justice had recently admitted to spying on Fox News chief Washington correspondent James Rosen to pursue criminal charges under the Espionage Act against State Department advisor Stephen Jin-Woo Kim, who had allegedly provided Rosen with confidential information on North Korea's nuclear tests. What's most disturbing to many First Amendment advocates is the FBI's characterization of Rosen as possibly being an aider and abettor and/or co-conspirator in the leaking of classified information. The aggressive pursuit of government leaks by the Obama White House has resulted in a doubling of the number of whistleblower investigations under the 1917 Espionage Act than in all previous presidential administrations combined. Your reporter spoke with Shahid Buttar, executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who explains why he believes the Obama Justice Department's surveillance of journalists' phone lines directly threatens America's First Amendment rights and freedom of the press.
The freedom of the press is one of the defining elements of a free society, and as we claim to lead the free world, we have long hung our hat on the principle that the media in the United States is free. The Justice Department's not merely request, but outright seizure of telecommunications by the Associated Press, it not only strikes a blow at the very heart of the First Amendment, but by striking a blow at the principle of a free press, and just to make it clear for your listeners, the press can't be free if its sources are available to the state. There is a crucial principle of source anonymity that animates press freedom, and when that anonymity is gone, when the press cannot report, for instance, state abuses, that is very definitionally part of authoritarianism, and we are tinkering, without meaning to and without anyone realizing it, the very underpinnings of our society. And I do think it is an open question at the moment whether the United States is even in the free world, let alone its leader. And I think these kinds of abuses on very fundamental freedoms are absolutely part of that concern.
As you just said, there are many critics out there who are talking about this Department of Justice collection of the Associated Press phone records as a very serious abuse of power, intimidation intended to chill investigative reporting. And I wonder if you could comment on what is your suggested method of limiting the government's ability to engage in this kind of spying on journalists in this post-9/11 era, where many of our civil liberties have been eroded.
Absolutely, and I think that's a crucial question. To his credit, and I say this with very much a grain of salt because I think President Obama has been very problematic on these issues. To his credit, he has, in the wake of the news stories about this seizure of records, come out in favor of a reporter shield law that would basically give reporters insulation from these kinds of government subpoenas. Now, here's the problem. First, he is prosecuting more government whistleblowers in the national security context in the last 5 years than in the entire preceding 225-year history of the Republic. And to propose a reporter shield law while viciously cracking down on whistleblowers, these are people in the federal bureaucracy who resign their careers to inform the public about important facts that are otherwise secret. The fact that the Obama administration is so viciously pursuing whistleblowers really stands in very sharp contrast to the welcome rhetoric about the reporter shield law. And absolutely, at a very minimum, we do need a reporter shield law, but we also need protections for whistleblowers. And it is long overdue for Congress and the executive branch to recognize the crucial role of whistleblowers. You know, I say this on the eve of Bradley Manning's trial at Fort Meade, and I think it's very telling that we prosecute people who try to expose to the public these very crucial facts about what acts are being committed in our name. It is very frustrating to see progressives co-opted by the Obama administration and consenting to or failing to criticize many of the very same abuses that under the Bush administration did cause us all very appropriate concern. Government secrecy is a problem. It doesn't matter who's at the top. Warrantless surveillance and dragnet wiretapping, it doesn't matter who's at the top. You know, these are not issues that we can simply dismiss merely because we have faith in the leaders at the top of the executive chain. And the fact that we've allowed the perpetuation of Bush-era abuses under the Obama administration and the silence of progressives in the wake of this ongoing assault, I think, is not only disappointing, but points to a particular weakness in the Republic.
Shahid Bhattar, as you and many of our listeners are aware, there are a lot of people in this country who believe that in an instance where national security is at stake and the safety of the population, that we can and should sacrifice civil liberties and our constitutionally guaranteed protections for things like freedom of the press. How do you respond to the idea that there should be exceptions to the rule, that if somehow the government perceives a danger, that they can cross that line and erode freedom of the press?
It puts the cart before the horse. The fundamental misunderstanding, people who would think that national security justifies the violation of core constitutional rights, forget what we're defending. It's not a territory, and it's not just a people, it's a set of principles, right? The struggle against violent extremism is a struggle about a set of principles, namely the right of the people to be governed as we wish instead of dictated to by violent, warmongers or promoters of whatever principles of radical faith they might espouse. It's the right of the people to have, for instance, freedom of religion. It's the right of the people, for instance, to know what our government is doing instead of, for instance, in some of the countries from which terrorism is being exported. You know, these are very closed governments. If we are interested in actually fighting a struggle to defend America, we can't compromise what America is at the outset. When we give up our civil liberties, we do the work of our enemies for them, right? Osama bin Laden did not bring down the United States. Bush did. And when you think about the damage wrought to our constitutional republic, two fallen office buildings in New York pale in comparison to the Patriot Act. They pale in comparison to the amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that let the NSA tap the back end of the internet and the phone system. They pale next to the horrible abuses of due process apparent at Guantanamo Bay. They pale next to the National Defense Authorization Act and the authority to detain Americans on the basis of suspicion without trial or proof of crime. We have inflicted vastly more damage on the United States by assaulting our own rights than any terrorists have ever committed through violent acts.
That was Shahid Bhattar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Find links to more news and information on groups challenging the erosion of civil liberties and press freedom on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.